Session number 13560, reel number 2.
Mr. Doughty, reel 2. What were conditions for the poor in Hull like at the time of the First World War?
Well, you can take that in the St. George's Road, which is a pleasant road, and it was developed by different builders, I suppose, because few of the houses are alike. And when they got to the school, this side were the managerial class, so the office type of executive. And a friend of mine, he's a chemist, and his father was a chemist, that type of person. Bernard Fosse is still alive, and so when you got past the gates, it continued reasonably, but then when you got to the fish stock area, you got a lot of poverty, you see, because of unemployment in many ways, and I suppose the lack of regular wages. Now, these boys came a fair way to my school. Others went at the other side of Hessel Road and formed, in some cases, very good football teams, because they were very weak boys, in a sense. And although they hadn't had the right food and that, in a certain time, it would show, I think, in illness and things like that. When they were young, they were very keen on football, all that area, and we were as well. But I particularly noticed when I was in school, and we sat one above the other to make a room smaller, you see. And a boy would come in and he'd be eating a crust, and then another one would come in and settle down and they'd say, "Have you had any breakfast?" And they'd try to find him something, and at the interval they all played these cigarette card games, you know. You never used your best cigarette cards, but if you threw it and it tipped another, you picked it up, you see. And I didn't play this game particularly because I liked to keep cigarette cards, and there were many forms of BDV had silk things that, you know, one's aunt would sew on an antimacassar. That's an antimacassar oil that you put on your hair, you see. And sewing and things were very fashionable. I mean, you judge people by how industrious they were, you see. I mean, for example, if you married someone in those days who frequented the fish and chip shop regularly, it would be frowned on by the mother-in-law, or anyone who was a very good baker or cook or provided more nourishing food than fish and chips. It was a kind of a snob angle in a way, but there was something about it, because I think with the young children, what was lacking in many cases was the money to buy sufficient good food.
Did the food supply deteriorate because of the First World War?
It became extremely dangerous in 1917, when before they started the convoy system, and were losing thousands of tons of shipping almost every week. And my sister and I were told to go to Jackson's stores. It became Grandways recently. These well-built corner shops, positioned in different roads, were highlighted as places to go to for soup. And you would take a big white jug, and it would be filled with beef soup. It was officially for children only, you see, and you'd bring it in, and my sister and I would have a bowl of it at least. And my grandfather, of course, going out in the country, when I went there, they would have a rabbit, which was quite legal, and he kept hens as well, you see, being from a farming background. And There was no real black market. You went and I think if you could afford it, you could buy chickens and ducks and things, but most people couldn't afford it. And there was a reasonable rationing system that wasn't maybe as stringent as it might have been thought. I never lacked anything. There was plenty of bread. And the strange thing is, they, in the Second World War, they reduced bread to 14 ounces, 1 pound 12 ounces, and for the benefit of the millers and the bakers, they've carried on with that. And we still have a less than a 1 pound and a 2 pound loaf. And as they more or less cleverly inject steam and put 16 gallons for the sack instead of 14, they do very well out of it, because if you get a wrapped loaf and take the cover off it and stand it near the fire, you were surprised to find what it weighs, because I was linked with this business and we opposed the use of, in a sense, chlorine to dye it white. And, we were very unpopular, but we won our case, and we found that wherever flour was being moved and there was any brass about it, the brass turned to a more a green colour. And we felt, really, it was wrong that people didn't know about this system.
Coming back to the beef soup, did you have to pay for it, or was it supplied by the government?
Oh, it was free. It was free, yes. Well, it might be some other soup. It would depend, you see. And also, I think they had the national kitchens where a meal could be obtained of a certain type. It would be something more or less like flour and potato. And in the Second World War, I phoned in and suggested that they, to the local corporation, that they had a service of mashed potato for bakers, which I think they did, actually, because I remembered it from the First World War, you see.
Were the national kitchens in the First World War?
The national kitchens sprung up in somewhere, the corporation buildings in the town somewhere, I think. And the national kitchens became an institution, I think, in the Second World War. We were lucky that I think we got enough meat to satisfy us. My father was a great meat eater, but we were only normal eaters, and I never really lacked for anything. There weren't many sweets, I remember. But as I say, after the bombing, we were with my mother's father and mother, and they had hens, and he wouldn't be a man. He was a good Christian. He wouldn't break the rationing law, but he might bring a rabbit in, and which is quite legal, and he'd no doubt bring another rabbit for his neighbour or his relatives up the street, you see. And in that sense, he might bring mushrooms in, and I would think that people who had landed in any shooting would do fairly well. I mean, there was duck flying over, wasn't there? I've been to our farms in Nottingham and Duke of Portland's estate, where they did a lot of duck shooting. I never liked shooting myself, but it was a weird noise when they came over, and I can understand people rather enjoy it, but I never... I once went shooting, and a man shot a pigeon, and he said, "Kill it, will you?" And its head came off, and I've always been rather sensitive. I never blew eggs. I thought that's a songbird that could sing.
What about Armistice Day in Hull in 1918? Can you remember?
Oh, that was a wonderful feature. The people really... went to town. They were more or less overcome, overjoyed, and particularly in the terraces, whereas before these boys had come in and hadn't been fed, the teachers helped them, And my mother would say, before the war, this was, if they say, give us the peel, Colonel, give us the core, which horrified me, she'd say, oh, take another apple or another orange for the boys, you see. And she'd been a teacher. And I was always surprised that boys could come without being fed. You know, you don't understand it, do you, when you've had a reasonable existence yourself and you feel like giving them half your breakfast or something, don't you, as a decent gesture. Anyway, my mother often plied me with things to give to these boys. And then, of course, when the war ended, there was a great celebration. They would take a terrace and they would chalk or paint the whole of the house where a man came in. There was V.C. Cornwallis, I think, whether he was in the Navy or the Army, what he was, a young man. And V.C. Cornwallis, remember that? And as I went with friends to see the celebrations in the poorer part of the town, they didn't celebrate in our section. They might have a flag up and that, but down there they just went crazy. And I would walk along and I'd be in some streets with these people who lived somewhere there, just as a sightseer, and say, sit down here, you two boys, come on, where's the so-and-so? And we'd be plied with all kinds of things, you know. And I used to feel out of my element. I didn't know any of them. But they're all cheering, and I suppose they were drinking and that, and they were overcome with joy. This carried on for about a week. And I happened to be one of the times at Flamborough, and they lit huge fires at Flamborough Head, and they sang songs like One Man Went to Mow, and I suppose they were drinking as well, but nobody was disorderly at any time. Perfectly safe for a young boy to run about amongst these people. And they certainly made a lot of the fires and fireworks at Flamborough. Some were the old lighthouses, I think. And but in Hull, what I do remember is that they after that, they had memorials to certain people who died. And they would give generously, and some joiner or carpenter would make a beautiful case, sometimes even in rosewood, and it would be fastened to a wall, and inside would be a plaque and with names of the people. And I always used to think as I walked past that how it was uncared for. After a while you'd see this and the glass would be broken and nobody would bother, and then the woodwork would go, and in the end I'd just see the marks on the walls. And it used to occur to me, isn't it strange that they didn't keep up these quite expensive memorials that you saw scattered about in various parts of the old of the the poorer parts of the town.
Who were they commemorating?
People in the terrace, people in the street who had died.
In the forces?
In the First World War, yes.
But in the armed forces? In the armed forces? Were there people who had been killed in the bombing?
Oh, yes.
In the
armed forces. There are a lot. You see, with it being the fish dock, the people went to sea, and many of them were sailors, I suppose. And then there were a lot of people drowned in just transportation work, weren't they? Merchant shipping and that. I could tell you a little story here, if you want one, about Jutland.
Please.
Would you like this?
Yes.
Well, I pioneered with two friends the laundrette business in about 1949, and we were vetted, had to go to see Bendix, and we didn't like Bendix's idea of whitewood tables and linos on the floor, paint it white and blue. That was all and we decided to put terrazzo on the floor. They said, oh, well, we want the services. So I said, well, we'll have drain pipes for the services, two water out, one water in, and telephones and gas and electricity, you see. And I don't know whether they do that now. And we put floorboards round the sides and painted blue and white and put flower vases and some very nice flowers up and that. And Bendix altered the leaflet to our design, actually. Kevin photographed it, and I said, look, I want a fibre for everyone we build. And as I was good-natured and friendly with them, and I'd been to their place to see them building the Bendix in the Austin Works, you see, nothing was said about that. And we carried on, and later, when we got about five or six up, Richard Roundtree, who didn't work in the organisation in York, asked if he could join us, and we let our staff go in caravans, and he built Middlesbrough, Hartlepool, York and Leeds. See. So I had a lot of experience in things like this, and I was quite pleased about it. So when we'd built one or two laundrettes, somebody said, oh, somebody else has built a laundrette in Hessel. So I went to see him and see who he was, and I found that he was called Walker, Sid Walker, and he'd been a skipper, I don't know whether he was with Helliers or who he was with, but he was a very interesting man, and I always liked to, I like people, I like to talk to people, I like to talk to, I met a lot of people that I watched when I was 10 playing football, internationals, and I met them personally later through business contacts, and I always liked to listen to people and hear about the industry and their work and the type of work they did. And he told me a very interesting story that he had a friend when he was at school on one of the Hessel Road schools, and he always wanted to go to sea, and so this friend dodged off without telling him and came back and said, I've joined the whole towing company, the Superman tow, the Super this and Super that, seagoing tugs. And so he said, well, why don't you tell me? He said, well, you can't, you're younger than me. He said, you haven't left. He said, I've left and I've joined. So he said, well, try and get me in, will you? So eventually he dashed off, and he was, they said he wanted to come, and they said he could come. And he used to go out with a mate, and he used to take the big empty things, no one living in them. I ought to know the name. Anyway, he used to take five or six of these on tow if they'd taken corn or wheat or anything down to Ranks Mill, and he worked this tug in for some months. And then one night they sent for him, and he used to think this mate was a marvellous man, and they sent a taxi for him, and he went down, and the mate was taking that tug, and the other skipper was taking his friend, and they set off, and it was the Battle of Jutland. And there he was, a boy of about 15, and not much experience, and they went off Bridlington, I don't know how far, and there was a light cruiser, about 20-something thousand tons, and it was listing badly. They were well away from the British shores, at any rate, and I don't know who was aboard, but there weren't many, and they decided that the best thing to do was, in a very heavy sea, was to take it gently and be careful of this list, you see. So the mates knew the coast very well, and he had this they had this rope on as well as a wire hawser, and they proceeded to go slowly, straight ahead because the sea was coming in from the south, you see. So it hadn't gone more than a mile or two when a young man in a destroyer came up and said, "Where are you for and what are you doing?" And he said, "I'm going straight ahead." So he said, "Yes, I'll keep an eye on you then." So he came again and said, "I want you to make for the Humber." So he said, "I can't make for the Humber in this sea." He said, "It's impossible." And all bawling and shouting, you see. And so he carried on, and the man came back and with a megaphone this time and said, "You know, to turn so many degrees." And he said, "I'm going to beach this at Bridlington or Hornsey. That's as far as I can turn." And so the man was furious and went away and came back and demanded that, you know, in the name of the Navy and the King and all that, he should turn. So I said, "Are you taking responsibility?" And he said, "As soon as they got through a certain number of degrees," he said, they slackened off the wire hawser and got ready with an axe to cut the rope. And he said, "As a young man," he said, "I saw that wonderful ship just go over and over, and it was lost about 10 miles off the coast." And he said, "My admiration for the mate compared to the Navy man was really marvellous," he said. I thought he was wonderful. Well, then Sid, tell me another story of...
What was this man's name?
Walker. Walker.
And do you know the name of the cruiser?
He'd be dead now, as Sid Walker. He was older than I was.
Do you know the name of the cruiser?
No, he didn't tell me that, no. And as a story about the sea, as I say, I had a friend whose father was a famous skipper, and he used to build this sand. He was a good builder. He did a bit of work for me. And I used to go into his bass house in Ellaby, and often, because of his father, the skippers went in there, and I used to listen to a lot of stories, and
in the First World War, was there a strong patriotic feeling that you remember, or not?
Oh yes, definitely yes. The Germans were not liked; they were hated, and there were songs about them as well, and jokes in the music halls. I can't remember them, but oh yes, there was no fifth column in this country at all. Anybody who'd spoken up for the Germans would have given short shift. It'd have been pushed out of a pub in no time. No, there's nothing like that. Although my father went to Germany before the war, and he bought a piano, a German piano, which was the best in the world. That was destroyed. And, of course, I could continue with my father's experience when he got leave because my mother was injured. And that possibly saved him, because when he went back, many of his battalion had gone. And later on, they wanted to amputate his arm, and he said that under the orders he wouldn't allow it. He wasn't going to sign anything until he demanded to come home and see his own doctor before they amputated his arm. And he came home, and I can remember him sitting in a chair with my stately Aunt Eleanor, dabbing his back, which was yellow and red in spots, with quinine, I think it would be, wasn't it? Iodine. And he'd jump a bit and that. And I've never seen anyone's back in such a condition. And the doctor actually saved his arm. So you never know what will happen. I mean, my father possibly lived because of my mother being damaged in an air raid, and and him refusing to have his arm amputated, you see. And so the end of that story is that, I will say, when he went to Germany, we used to play with soldiers, and we used to have these little guns that fired matchstocks, and they were the wire trigger guns that you wouldn't use because they'd damage them. And he brought me some cavalry, German cavalry, Uhlans, and soldiers and that, and he said to, I remember him saying, you know, Britain is being a bit negligent, the Germans in steel and finishing, and their soldiers, they're getting to be better than we are, the detail of finish. And of course, they had something about the steel that was harder. You see, we lost the sister ship in each war, the Hood, that their armour piercing was better than our defensive armament. And the two ships that were sister ships were destroyed in different wars. My father also said he saw the Americans come into action, and he said he felt terribly sorry for them. And he said they had all kinds of gear for the comfort, and there was no room for comfort of that nature. They had hot water bottles and chest protectors that were not too light, you see. And you can remember how all these things in time were discarded, you know. It was a matter of salvation, not carrying heavy things about, you know, on the odd chance of the useful, you see. He was very sorry for them, suddenly coming from a country life into this. And I also met some Americans in the Second World War. I've always liked the Americans. And he, at the end of the war, came back and found that he'd lost everything he had, some beautiful furniture and his German piano, and he had